This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. At an NCAA tournament press conference last year, a reporter asked this question.
The NCAA tournament is like a book, and each team has their own unique chapter. You guys showed a lot of perseverance losing your team leader. What are you guys doing to adjust and fill in the chapter?
He sounds young because he is young, just 12 years old. His name is Vedanth Gupta, and he wants to become a household name. Here's reporter Shirley Wong.
If you go to any major sports event, look towards the press gaggle. Look for a kid in a navy suit with a yellow-tipped toy mic and a dad clearing a direct path to his son's next interview subject. Here's kid reporter Vedanth Gupta making his way. If you haven't been hearing about him, don't worry. You will be. At least, that's his plan. He isn't just some sweet-faced, sweet-talking 12-year-old kid. He is a brand. He is the president of his two-person company, Global Kid Media. Vedanth knows that every good businessman has a good elevator pitch, a quick introduction that lasts as long as an elevator ride. This is Vedanth's.
So my name is Vedanth Gupta, and I'm the president of my own media company, Global Kid Media. For the past 18 months, I've been covering NFL, NBA, college, talking to the biggest names, and I'm trying to break through as the first kid on national TV to inspire all the other kids that they can do anything at any age.
Inspire other kids. Vedanth wants to be the first reporter his age. But you may have noticed, his voice has dropped. He's getting older, and he's only got 736 followers on Instagram. So far, Vedanth has struck it big once or twice, getting honored at small-town meetings, landing appearances on local TV.
During Tom Izzo's press conference, he waited his turn and got a chance to ask the coach a question.
I'm Vedanth Gupta. So you guys you score big on the court, but you also score big off the court, such as doing things like helping with the Flint water crisis, helping with people who have cancer. What's it like to know that you're representing those people?
Well, what a good question by the most well-dressed guy in the room.
For the past 2 years, Vedanth has been trying to grow his brand, using Instagram, YouTube, and even LinkedIn to share quick video interviews with sports celebrities. Interview anyone he can, from football moms to eavesdropping bartenders to college-level players. Hit him in the sidelines and find a way to make it into the press conferences. One day, he could lead a movement, his dad says. But before all that is just Vedanth and his dad, watching sports at home in suburban Michigan, studying up on sports' biggest stars. When Vedanth and I spoke a few months ago, it was 2 days before his 13th birthday. I asked him how he felt about going from age 12 to 13.
You know, for me, a year and a half ago, I was really nowhere with media. So in just that short period of time, I've been able to go from nowhere to having my own company and talking to guys like Zion Williamson, Patrick Mahomes, Magic Johnson, Deion Sanders, and we think nearly 1,000 interviews now. So I think, you know, going to 13, yeah, I'm starting to get a little bit older, and I can't say I'm not a teenager anymore. But, you know, going into 13, I feel like for me, this is going to be the year where I really want to break through.
You think this is the year?
I think this is the year, yeah.
Vedanth believes becoming a teen isn't going to stop him. His dad, Vipul, sees it a bit differently. He's worked in the field of marketing, and he knows how this thing works. He knows that adorableness doesn't last forever.
He was really cute when he first covered the NCAA tournament in March of 2018. That was kind of his first foray into everything.
I mean, is 13 so different from 12?
I guess in a sense it is, because when you say 11 or 12, you still think a little bit more of kid. And when you say 13, you know, you might be thinking, well, they're almost 14, 15.
Life is connections, his dad writes to me in an email. He is at that point where doors will stay closed or finally they will open. Vipul didn't always want to work in sports. His parents were from India. He was born in America. He got his MFA and wanted to be a broker between Hollywood and Bollywood. America needed Bollywood, he thought. If Chinese martial art films had gone mainstream, so could movie stars like Karishma Kapoor, Shah Rukh Khan, and Juhi Chawla, all people who were megastars in India's massive film industry. So when they visited his home state of Michigan on tour, Vipul would wait.
I would hang out for hours and hours and hours, you know, just waiting for an opportunity to get 2 seconds to talk to the promoter. And then he would introduce me, or she would introduce me to a star, and then basically create a relationship, and I would tell the stars what I was trying to do.
Sometimes people would just brush him off. To them, Vipul was just another scrappy random. Meanwhile, Vipul was zeroed in completely.
Just doing what I needed to do. So yeah, it was pretty much, it just wasn't really making anything, just like right now, but you know, that's okay. We just strive hard and hope that the success will come when it comes.
In 2006, Vedant was born. So Vipul started using what he'd learned from his failed Bollywood experiment and encouraged his son to do things that technically he wasn't supposed to do. First, Vedant, as a third grader, entered in a speech tournament meant for middle schoolers. And it was there he learned he could communicate uncommonly well.
I got second place.
Then, years later, as an 11-year-old, Vedant applied for a national program for kids to develop as reporters. Instead of waiting to get accepted, his dad encouraged him to start contacting media departments anyway, using the organization's name. He started calling universities and asking for press credentials.
I had made probably 50 phone calls to schools asking if I could get in.
But the organization got mad at Vedant, telling him he misused its name.
Even though every time I was saying that I'm applying for this organization. But anyway, that's when we, you know, thought, let's do it on our own.
So began the Global Kid Media Company, of which Vedant didn't have to be just an applicant or trainee. He could be president. Truth was, when Vedant wasn't in school, he was on the job all the time. For a Duke-Miami game in March, Vipul pulled him out of class. Then they drove 11 hours to get from Flint, Michigan to North Carolina.
It was probably about 1 in the morning when we got there, and then I said to him that, you know, well, the actual campus and where Cameron Indoor Stadium is about 10 minutes away. Let's go see it. And, you know, of course he was tired and it was late in the morning. You know, he was a little bit reluctant, but I said, hey, this is part of what it is to scout something, to know something, to research something. So we spent about an hour there looking around the place and just getting the lay of the land. And then we went to the hotel.
People weren't shy about telling Vipul to his face that he was being too much of a helicopter parent. He says he's not. What he is, he says, is a fighter jet pilot. Doesn't hover around as much and is strict, but adventurous. The father-son duo is used to late nights paired with early mornings. They would also stay up to scout hotels, trying to catch celebrities in more casual moments. I asked Vedant to tell me about one of those trips. His dad cued him.
Minneapolis.
So we were in Minneapolis covering the Final Four, and we didn't have game credentials. The next couple nights, we spent until maybe 3 or 4 a.m. going hotel to hotel trying to catch coaches and players.
We had a hotel clerk giving us the eye, too. She was like, what are you guys doing here? And then, you know, he had
once Vedant was at a sports facility trying to talk to a player who was running a youth camp.
And then the next thing we knew, we had 6 security guards surrounding us. And they said, you guys are not welcome here, and if you come back again, we're going to call the police next time. It's a very difficult, even a little bit traumatic situation when you have security guards surrounding you.
How do you sort of feel about putting Vedant in these situations? How does it feel to you?
It feels like you want to go crawl under a rock and just you feel worthless. Initially, it's kind of like a feeling of just feeling so low, but at the end of the day, I mean, when you reflect upon it, I think it makes you stronger and it makes you appreciate what other people go through. And so I'm very happy he's also getting those experiences in a sense. And I know that sounds strange, but it's going to make him be a lot more.
Vipul pushes his son because he knows what it's like to regret. It was something he never wanted his son to feel. Back when Vipul was working Bollywood, people would say things to him like, come out to Los Angeles next week and we'll talk. He never went. He worried that upon arrival, there would be no promises, no guarantee of any meeting, no reimbursement for the ticket or a place to stay. He never asked. That was his one regret. Otherwise, he says, he gave it his all. And it seemed like when you gave something your most aggressive try and were willing to do things no one else would, it should be rewarded. Eventually, Vipul couldn't shake the feeling that he just wasn't smart enough to pull it all off. It was like he was being put in his place. So now Vipul knows. Each drive hours away to chauffeur his son to yet another game is a promise to himself that his son will have it all. The persistence, the risk-taking, the belief in himself. And his son won't be questioning himself, because that doesn't work. Vedant doesn't have doubts about his fate. It's not a thing a 13-year-old thinks about, not yet. Because Vedant, he loves his hobby, he really does.
For me, even if this was a complete failure, if I inspired even 100 kids or something like that, then knowing that I'm going to keep going, and if it fails, I'll start something else.
And Vedant has gotten to meet some of the celebrities he's watched on TV, who've said things like...
So you're 12 years old.
Yep.
What made you decide to be a brilliant sportscaster?
That's a really good question. And you're a president of your own media company. Mm-hmm. Look out, Elon Musk, man.
When I tell Vedant he sounds just like his dad, he says, thanks. Not in a tone that older people use when they're secretly spinning into existential dread, but like, thanks, my dad is great. It's genuine. Vedant, though, he's getting older. Being a teen is not the same as being a kid. Things that were cool to you once are cool no more. And while Vedant gets older, he and his dad fight.
Maybe the longest it's ever lasted is, 5 minutes? So I know within 5 minutes we'll probably be outside playing basketball or something like that. Even when we play sports and things, it gets pretty heated up. But
yeah, the poor kid can't quite keep up with me, but he tries. You know, I feel for him. So he's giving his best shot, right? I mean, unfortunately, he's learned one bad quality, that he likes to call out of fouls when they're not there. So isn't that true, Vinod? You can vouch for that on air here. He's kind of quiet now. I never see myself as really a dad type. I mean, other than sometimes you got to give guidance. I think it's more like, I mean, I view him as a best friend and a brother, and, you know, somebody that I just enjoy hanging out with.
Did you know that about your dad, Vedant, that he sees you as his best friend?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, he's a 50, what are you, like, so much older than me for a brother, but whatever it is.
I'm not quite 50.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all right. Age is just a number, actually.
Vedant, is your dad your best friend?
I guess, yeah, kind of.
You don't have to say that.
Not really.
One of them, maybe.
I mean, he's my friend, but my best friends are, you know, the ones who stuck with me since kindergarten.
He still doesn't like me being so rough on him sometimes, so I'm not quite at that best category yet. I'm a friend, but maybe not his best friend, huh? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Maybe Vipul isn't his son's best friend, but he is there, trying to make sure his son isn't alone. And he'll be holding the camera for Vedant's next interview, ready for his son to shine.
That's reporter Shirley Wong. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Wake up to a fresh take on the day's news with Up First every weekday morning, and now Saturdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, too.
10 minutes is all you'll need to start your day informed, and now you can listen 6 days a week.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First to start your weekend from NPR News.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for 3 stories you should know. Earlier this week, news broke that Colin Kaepernick would work out for NFL teams in Atlanta, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and by The Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Hi, Karen.
Okay, so as the whole world knows by now, the NFL has invited Colin Kaepernick to hold a workout. Sources say the league arranged this event after at least 2 teams checked in on Kaepernick's status, which is odd because if there is in fact no collusion, there would be no need to check with the league about whether Cap is available. The fact that Cap is available has been a major story since, March 9th, 2017. But anyway, the fact that this is happening on a Saturday, when roughly half of all coaches and general managers will be traveling for Sunday's games is also odd. These kinds of workouts normally happen on Tuesdays. And all of this has led some to suggest that this event might be a bit disingenuous. Call it a PR stunt, as Panthers safety Eric Reed did, but it definitely does not fall into the realm of normal NFL operating behavior. So what do we make of this? Ben?
Well, to me, the publicity stunt part is very odd because there is no media involved. The only people who are going to be able to see the workout are the scouts and the executives and presumably people from Colin Kaepernick's camp. This is actually quite strange for the NFL because this is a league that has done as much as any American sports league to carve up its media rights deals. I mean, they have right. made the process of the NFL draft longer than the NBA playoffs at this point. Like, if they put this thing on TV, if they made a media circus out of it, it would be huge. It would be bigger than the NBA. It would be bigger than college football on Saturday for sure.
I hadn't thought of that, but it's a good point. This is the NFL at its most restrained, at its most understated. Such dignity. 11 or so teams said they'd be attending the workout, and most of them are teams, it makes sense, either their current quarterback might play a running style like the Arizona Cardinals or perhaps the Baltimore Ravens. Then you have the teams with just bad quarterbacks. The Broncos will be there. Do the NFL owners, do NFL scouts, do they really need this to know that Colin Kaepernick is out there and available? Every time there's an injury, it's always mentioned in the media, and his representatives have been reported to have been contacting teams every so often. Hey, yeah. Kaepernick's out there.
Yeah, I find the idea, and maybe the sources are incorrect, those sources that say that this is because at least two teams contacted the league and asked about his status. But really, like, every time a quarterback stubs his toe, someone in a press conference says, why don't you get Kaepernick? So it's all very strange.
And if you do, and if you are a Kaepernick fan, do you really want to put him behind the Bengals offensive line? I'm just saying.
All right, Ben, you're up.
Okay, so I don't know if you guys remember this, but last year on ESPN, Stephen A. Smith went on live national television and he said, Carmelo Anthony, and then he paused for 7 seconds, just total silence, and he said, Carmelo Anthony is bad. Now, I want to say the New York Knicks are bad. How bad are they? Well, if you look at their record over the last 500 games, it turns out the Knicks haven't been this bad since the 1960s. That is more than a half century
the glory of being bad.
And the worst part about this is that it didn't have to be this way. In fact, it actually wasn't long ago that they were actually pretty good in pretty interesting ways. So the year was 2013. You may not believe this, but the Knicks broke the NBA record for three-pointers that season. They had the most productive offense in the history of the team. They won 54 games. They made the playoffs. They won a playoff series. They were fun. They were relevant. The New York Knicks were operating like a perfectly competent professional basketball team. And then they weren't. They had a peek of the future, and they were like, we're okay. We'll go back to being the Knicks. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say the New York Knicks are bad.
Mike?
Yeah, they're really bad. Their roster construction makes no sense. Let's just get some more guys to clog up the middle. Let's get this amazing player, Mitchell Robinson, and play him like 18 minutes a game. Of course, you know, if you play him 19, he'll probably foul out. Their coach is not good. I don't understand. He can't, Fizdale can't set a rotation. They even had a press conference earlier this week, essentially publicly criticizing the coach, the owner, who's really bad. I don't have enough seconds to pause before how bad I allege that James Dolan is. It's frustrating because I live two blocks from the Barclays Center and I was very intent on becoming a Nets fan, but I'm just so bothered by the fact that their owner is essentially doing propaganda for the Chinese government. That said, he's probably a morally better person than James Dolan, but still, it gives me pause.
You know, sometimes I feel bad that we make fun of the Knicks all the time.
Don't.
This week, fans took video of six stadium guards removing a fan from his seat for chanting "Fire Dolan." And like, this became a whole thing. The Knicks made it clear they didn't kick the guy out of the stadium for his chant. But then the fan fired back and he said that they told him they would kick him out if he kept chanting. And so he chose to leave. Ben, is there anything this ownership team gets right?
That is a great question. I mean, what I was going to say is that there are plenty of NBA teams that are bad and that they actually choose to be bad for a few years and then they become good. The worst and the most frustrating part of all of this is that the New York Knicks are not even good at being bad, and that is their problem.
All right, Mike, you're up.
So I've been watching the show on CNBC. It's Alex Rodriguez rehabbing former athletes like Evander Holyfield and Joe Smith and Ryan Lochte and, for some reason, the comedian Brian Dunkelman, who was on American Idol. The name of the show is Back in the Game, and the premise is that A-Rod comes in to these athletes who frittered away their fortunes, and because A-Rod is wise... I will hold that for a few seconds, but not seven, because A-Rod is so wise, he can advise a Ryan Lochte-like figure how to get, indeed, back in the game. Given that framework, it's not as horrible as it could be. A-Rod comes, he talks about the accomplishments of the athlete. There's a little bit of superiority porn built in where all the regular people like me can say, oh my God, look at how much he had and I can't believe he spent it. And then A-Rod, because he's wise, works to help the athlete make a little more money. Just a really weird show that's bad, formulaic. But, it's kind of like, I hate to say it, but I can't look away.
Ben?
Well, I'm curious, Mike, how would you fix the show? Like, is it the financial part of it that doesn't make sense? Is it Alex Rodriguez? You're the showrunner of it. What do you do?
Right. So that's a great question. And I've done stories, I bet you have too, on athletes who had it all and lost it all. It can't always be a redemption story. I would think at some cases you would go and you'd say, look, this is beyond help and you cannot be rehabbed. We could maybe just understand how it happened. That would be a little more interesting to me.
Would you watch that show, Ben?
I would, yeah. I do think that Alex Rodriguez has reinvented himself as this sort of charismatic, compelling television figure in a way that nobody saw coming. Now, this is obviously a leap from being a baseball analyst where he has emerged as this sort of savant on television who explains the game very intelligently.
It was really interesting to me because I, too, have been, like, caught up in this, oh, I'm starting to like A-Rod. Like, he's maybe not such a bad guy. And I find myself having these conversations about how interesting his turnaround has been and how he seems to have, like, you know, worked on himself in that he went to lots of therapy and figured out why he had been such a jerk for a long time and stopped being such a jerk, maybe, or maybe just in front of cameras, you know. And then he goes and does this thing. And I got to say, the part of it that I can't handle is that whenever the topic gets really serious, they cut away to like the serious A-Rod face. Like this really serious, he kind of nods and he kind of looks at the camera. I mean... Mike, how do you not just laugh at that?
Yeah, he's also the host of the show, but he's also an interview subject, and he's not facing the camera when he talks. He's facing some interlocutor off camera. It's very odd. It's like we're getting to observe Alex Rodriguez in the wild with his baseball acumen. And by the way, yeah, he's better than we thought he'd be, but if you really want to waste a number of hours, listen to Alex Rodriguez broadcast a baseball game. There's not a ton of insight.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and The Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Here at Only a Game, we search far and wide for the very best stories set in sports. But sometimes we don't have to look very hard. Only a Game's Martin Kessler heard about this next story in his kitchen from his roommate who works for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston. Here's Martin.
8-year-old Kata is on the swim team at the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston's Charlestown Club.
It's really fun, and we usually get to... We get to play games, too, at the end. And I also really like diving off the diving block.
What kind of games do you play?
Sharks and Minnows and Fishy Fishy.
Kata's coach is Colby Cahill, the aquatics director at the Charlestown Club. Colby also teaches kids at the club how to swim.
We have them do bobs. We try to teach them how to float.
How tall are your typical swimmers?
I think they range from 3 feet to, like, probably, like, 4:10, something like that.
But a few weeks ago, Colby learned from her boss, Derek, that she was getting a new student.
So Derek actually came up to me and he was like, we have a Celtics player who wants to come in. And at first I thought they just wanted to like help out with the swim lesson. I didn't know that they didn't actually know how to swim until someone told me. So when he came in, I literally looked all the way up and I was like, oh my goodness, how am I gonna do this?
Colby's new student wasn't just any Celtics player. It was rookie Taco Fall.
Taco's in the game.
Taco's here. And everyone loves him.
Doesn't take much to jam that home when you're 7'6".
Taco Fall is listed on the Celtics roster at 7'5". And since signing with Boston last July as an undrafted free agent, Taco has been more than a Celtics fan favorite. He's become one of the most closely followed and cheered for basketball players in the world. A couple weeks ago, ESPN's Jackie McMullen wrote that, quote, Fall's on-court appearances at the NBA Summer League were greeted with the same enthusiasm as the coronation of the king. But for someone who draws a royal reaction, Taco Fall seems to have simple tastes.
All right.
Do you want to just tell me what you had for breakfast to set a level on your voice?
What I had for breakfast today, oatmeal with yogurt. Oatmeal with yogurt is like the cheat code. You put yogurt in oatmeal, it's good.
Taco Fall is 23 years old. He grew up in Dakar, Senegal.
Dakar is a very small city, but it's a lot of people.
And how close were you to the water?
I was right by the water. Like it's not an island, but it's like, I would say, Dakar was like 60-70% surrounded by water.
Taco says if other houses weren't in the way, he could have seen the water from his home. Would your friends and stuff, would they go swimming growing up?
All the time. But my mom wouldn't, she never really let me do it.
Why not?
Because she was just too, everywhere she went, I went with her. Like, she would never let me leave her sight.
She was just sort of worried about you or wanted to watch out for you.
Yeah.
So Taco didn't go to the beach with his friends, never learned to swim. But when he was a teenager, he did leave his mom to go to the U.S. to pursue basketball. He ended up at a high school in Florida, where he scored in the 95th percentile on the SAT and reportedly drew interest from the Harvard and Princeton basketball teams. Taco signed on to play basketball at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, about an hour from Daytona Beach. Did your friends know that you couldn't swim?
Oh, yeah. Everybody knew I couldn't swim. I mean, I never really had a shame saying I couldn't swim because it's just, yeah, I can't swim.
Back in high school, Taco said he'd rather grow up to be Steve Jobs than LeBron James, and someday he might still work in tech. But after graduating from UCF in May, Taco signed with the Celtics. That's how he got to know Celtics Vice President of Public Relations Heather Walker, who used to work as a lifeguard. When the two were talking before the season, she learned that Taco had never learned to swim.
And she said, I'm going to make a commitment to get you to learn how to swim. I'll say, sure, I'll do it. And that's how it started.
The Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston's Charlestown Club is located just across the Charles River from the Celtics' home arena, the TD Garden.
You can look out one of our windows and you can see the garden from where we are.
That's Derek Gallagher, executive director of the Charlestown Club. Derek grew up in a housing development down the street from the club in the 70s and 80s. He made it to a lot of Celtics games.
But I'm going to be honest with you. There was a building across the street where if you went up, a guy from Charlestown worked on the elevator. You went across like a little walkway. And the Bull Gang who sets the floor and stuff, they're all from Charlestown. So you just walked in. You had to find a seat, but I got in the building whenever we wanted. So for years and years and years, that's what my friends did. So I probably owe the Celtics a few dollars.
Derek grew up going to the Charlestown Club. That's where he got good enough at swimming to become a lifeguard. He worked his way up through the organization, going from junior staff to athletic director to program director. And he says about 15 years ago, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston came up with a goal. Every kid in the club would learn to swim.
Doesn't mean you're going to be doing the 400 IM and the swim team, but you're going to learn enough where if you were to fall in the water, caught in a riptide, if you were on a jetty and you're able to swim, tread water, be able to get yourself to safety, because that to us, it's a life skill.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2017, drowning was the second leading cause of injury death for children ages 5 to 9 across the U.S., and the fifth leading cause for children 10 to 14. And children who grow up in cities or in poorer communities usually have less access to swimming lessons and pools. So every day, Colby Cahill, aquatics director, is at the club in Charlestown giving lessons. And that presented an opportunity for Taco Fall and the Celtics. Taco could go to the Charlestown Club to learn to swim and to raise awareness about drowning risk. So in late September, Colby's new student showed up.
The kids were going crazy. At first, they were like, oh my God, who is this guy? And then once like they realized who it was, they were going, oh my God, get in the water, like, come on.
But getting in the water wasn't so easy for Taco Fall.
I did not want to let go of the side of the, I was a little bit scared to drown.
Well, how deep was the pool? Because it would have to be pretty deep for you to drown.
I'm like the 5-6 feet out.
But Taco got more and more comfortable.
3, 2, 1.
He was awesome. He was like one of my best students, honestly.
Taco and the kids worked on holding their breath underwater, floating, paddling.
And if our kids see an NBA player who's looking to learn how to swim, of course they're going to want to learn how to swim. So to us, this makes our job easier.
But one lesson wasn't going to be enough. So a few weeks later, Taco Fall returned to the pool. 8-year-old Kata from the swim team was there.
Like, I've never seen, like, a really tall person, no matter where he is, it's the shallow end, and it's up to his ribs. And he needed 5 kickboards and a stack so he can float.
Yeah, how many kickboards do you need normally?
1.
Kata and her older brother, Zoltan, were happy to help Taco out.
He said, how do you swim that fast and how can you breathe?
And I told him to try pushing off the wall a little harder.
Taco says this time, for his second lesson, he was no longer scared of drowning. And he brought along 2 of his teammates, Grant Williams and Shemi Ojale.
Grant did really good. Shemi and I were... I did better than Shemi, I thought.
Colby could notice a difference in her tallest student.
The second time, he was, like, jumping in. He was, like, showing, like, Grant and Shemi what to do. And, like, he showed Grant how to do a bob properly. And so instead of, like, the kids wanting to demonstrate, he was actually demonstrating for his friends.
I think it's cool to go to the pool and I have to just sit on the side. And it actually feels really relaxing. Like, Shemi and I were talking about it last time we went to the pool. We had practice that morning. I was really sore. I'm sure he was sore, too. But as soon as we got out, like, our joints and everything was just... I feel really good.
About a week after Taco's second trip to the pool, the Celtics were in New York to play the Knicks. Late in the game, with the Celtics in control, Taco Fall made his NBA debut.
Rolling to the basket to throw it up. He gets 2. His first career NBA points.
What he's doing right now, he looks a lot better. He looks a lot better.
Could it be the swimming? Probably not. But either way, Taco Fall isn't going to stop now. Taco is now with the Celtics G League affiliate in Portland, Maine. But he and the Celtics have already found a Boys and Girls Club up there that's happy to have him. His next swimming lesson is already on the calendar.
I think some people are afraid to say that they can't swim, but don't be afraid. Go out there and try it.
That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For the past 3 years, Seattle's Roller Derby League has been looking for a new home. In May, they ran out of time.
We're putting everything in a storage unit for a while, which is really sad. Taking down the posters off our wall and disassembling the bleachers. And it's hard for me to go up there. I'm supposed to help with that, but it's so sad.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. So you're listening to this NPR podcast because you want to be informed. You want to learn something. But what if you need a little break? Well, then you want to check out Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. It's the show that lets your lizard brain enjoy itself for once. You can be serious again later. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, why Teddy Roosevelt called baseball a mollycoddle game. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
The baseball world is all aflutter this week over a report claiming the Houston Astros stole signs during their 2017 championship season. I'm shocked. Shocked. You?
No. There are some things that I just like tuck into the category of gamesmanship. And this is one of them, although I do have to admit the technology is a little bit amazing.
Well, I mean, we call it technology, but it's relatively low tech. They apparently just watched a feed from the center field camera and then banged on a trash can for a breaking ball or off-speed pitch. Simple yet effective.
Well, it was a very high-tech trash can. I mean, I think it was probably, it might have been one of those, you know, solar-powered ones.
Those are high-tech. Fans started immediately apologizing to then-LA Dodgers pitcher Yu Darvish, who gave up 8 runs in just 3.5 innings over 2 starts in the 2017 World Series. But, I mean, even if the Astros were stealing signs in those particular games, it wouldn't fully account for what happened to Darvish, right?
No, you still have to hit the ball. And, of course, most famously is the, you know, the revisionist history now that Bobby Thompson had the benefit of a stolen sign when he hit the home run in 1951, probably the most famous home run in baseball history.
Well, MLB has plans to interview the Astros, the Red Sox, and the Mets, and that's because Red Sox manager Alex Cora and recently hired Mets manager Carlos Beltran were with the Astros in 2017 and allegedly participated in the scheme. Say it isn't so.
Oh, the scheme, the scheme, the scheme. There will be fines all the way around, and by the middle of next May, no one will remember this.
Really? No big deal?
I don't think so, no. I mean, it'll be a big deal for a while. I mean, what can they do? They're not going to throw these guys out of baseball. I don't think they'll suspend anybody for it.
Well, Tom Verducci at SI made a good point. He says the Astros front office isn't made up of baseball guys. It's made up of banking and finance guys. They're looking for any incremental advantage, and that means it's perfectly okay to bang on a trash can or trade for a guy who's been suspended for domestic violence. What do you make of the idea that these two things are connected?
I don't think the two things are connected at all. As much as I distrust anybody in the American financial services industry these days, you don't need to hire a banker to find a baseball guy that'll cheat. I think, you know, 150 years of history have proven that.
Good point. Charlie, we finally have an answer to the existential question, will anyone sign Carmelo Anthony? And the answer is the Portland Trailblazers. I didn't see that one coming. Did you?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I mean, I still think he's got some talent. I still think he can contribute. I am sort of surprised that it took him so long, and I'm surprised that he went so cheaply and was essentially picked up as a spare part.
Yeah, it's a non-guaranteed contract. Melo will join the Blazers for a 6-game road trip, and then I guess we'll see what happens from there.
Right. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I think he'll stay. I think he's still got, as they say, gas left in the tank.
The last time Notre Dame failed to sell out a game was Thanksgiving Day, 1973, and that streak will end this weekend. Are you dismayed?
That's really remarkable when you think about it. 1973, Thanksgiving Day of 73, was my junior year in college.
And finally, Charlie, the Financial Times issued a very important correction this week, and I'm just going to let you explain it.
Yeah, the Financial Times made a point to point out that the Salt Lake Tribune has 2 jazz reporters.
Small J jazz, like the music.
You know, if you're the Village Voice, having 2 jazz reporters would make sense.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the Financial Times did not take into account the fact that there's a basketball team called the Utah Jazz. I find that sometimes hard to take into account myself. Nevertheless, there are 2 reporters for the Salt Lake Tribune who cover the Utah Jazz. No clarinets need apply.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Roller derby is an aggressive, physical sport. It's also one of the few contact sports dominated by women, and it's thriving. The Women's Flat Track Derby Association has 457 member leagues on 6 continents. But now those leagues have a new nemesis, gentrification. Eilish O'Neill has our story from Seattle.
This is the Rat's Nest.
It's the home of the Rat City Roller Girls, a four-team league in the International Women's Flat Track Derby Association.
It's been a really great place. It's kind of perfect.
That's Carmen Thomas. She's been skating for Rat City since the league's founding 16 years ago. The Rat's Nest is an old warehouse north of Seattle. It's located on a highway with a reputation for sketchy motels and frequent crime. Exposed electrical wires are strung along one of the walls, and a couple of the metal rolling doors are partly open for airflow. Most of the space is taken up by an orange track painted on the floor. There's a table for officials and a loft for filming the game, so the girls can watch themselves afterwards.
We have space on the side for bleachers. We have enough bathrooms. It's the perfect venue.
And now, Rat City has to leave.
Well, we're packing up this week. I think tomorrow we're doing the big move out for a lot of stuff. We're putting everything in a storage unit for a while, which is really sad. Taking down the posters off of our wall and disassembling the bleachers, and it's just going to be an empty warehouse. It's hard for me to go up there. I'm supposed to help with that, but it's so sad.
It sucks that it's gone.
Not everyone would break into tears over a roller derby rink, but Carmen says she's always been a crier.
I'm a softie. I cry at the drop of a hat. One of my teammates actually made me this cry shield, which is a piece of paper with a silly picture of my face on one side and like a silly picture of a dog on another side. So I could hold this in front of my face, because once I started crying, other people would start to cry.
Did it work then it wouldn't set off this chain reaction?
I think it made it more of a funny thing and kind of okay for me and for other people to cry.
15 years ago, when Carmen was 27, she heard three Seattleites were trying to start a roller derby league.
And I said, where do I sign up? Because I've always, always wanted to do that. I always watched roller derby when I was very young with my great uncle Jack, because he loved watching roller derby. And I would go to the roller skating rinks on Saturdays, and I'd always get in trouble for knocking people around a little bit, because that was something I always wanted to do.
So Carmen went to the first practice ever held for this new league. At the time, she was working as an auto tech at a truck dealership.
And I showed up covered in brake dust, and I had some, you know, the Elvis-style sunglasses on. I walked in with some pigtails.
All of the skaters were recruited to help get the derby league off the ground.
We would have, you know, five-hour-long meetings at the rendezvous over the French fries and beers, and, you know, because of French fries and beers, it tends to last longer than it probably should and maybe not be as focused as it should. But you get to know these people really intimately.
A year or two after Rat City's founding, an old back injury Carmen had gotten working as an auto mechanic flared up. She couldn't lift anything. And that was a problem because she and her partner were moving. Carmen has parents and a sister in Seattle, but they aren't the people she called to help her move.
I called my derby family, like my teammates. I'm like, hey, can you help me? Maybe six people showed up, and before I knew it, everything was packed up in the van.
Carmen says that's the moment she knew. This was her family.
A group of women, strong women, they were my support group. They're my, like, chosen family.
Carmen wanted to bring derby to the next generation, so she helped found Rat City's Youth League, the Derby Brats, which has since grown into one of the largest youth roller derby leagues in the country. Mike Van Flander is the current board president. He got involved because of his younger daughter, Erin.
She has struggled since a very young age with anxiety. When she experiences the anxiety, she tends to shut down, to disengage, and she begins to cry.
Erin gave her father permission to talk with me, but didn't feel comfortable doing an interview herself. Mike thought sports might help Erin develop the skills she needed to cope, but
she did not enjoy most athletics. She didn't enjoy team sports. She struggled when she felt like she was being watched or judged, and most of the sports just weren't fun for her, so she tried a large variety of things and gave up on most of them.
But one thing Erin did love was roller skating. One weekend when she was at a skating rink with her family, she saw a poster for a youth roller derby league. The league was hosting a summer camp to teach newbies the basics. When Erin said she was game, Mike signed her up.
At this derby camp, she would do these difficult things, be skating and have people pushing on her and touching her, and she would be falling down and failing to live up to her expectations, and she would burst into tears. And we would have difficult car rides home where she talked about the things that she was saying to herself, that she wasn't good enough and that she couldn't do this. But she loved the activity enough that she would face those fears and keep coming back.
Mike says when Erin started derby 6 years ago, she would never have opened her mouth in front of a stranger. But the sport has changed her.
When she's out there and her team needs to pull back together and she'll scream at the top of her lungs, come on, let's go, wallop. And I look at that and I think, who is that kid? I love seeing that side of her. And I love that derby brings that out of her.
Mike says it's not just his daughter. Many girls could use a space like this.
Fewer young girls join sports than boys. And as they hit their teen years, the attrition rates, depending on whose statistics you look at, are 2 to 6 times that of boys. And a lot of that is our unconscious social messages that athletics is not feminine. Roller derby for me is an opportunity for my two daughters to have those types of experiences that boys who can go out and play football just take for granted.
Then, this spring, all those opportunities were thrown into doubt. Carmen was at a league meeting when she first heard the building would be demolished to make room for a mixed-use development with retail on the ground floor and apartments up above.
I think my immediate thought was, well, that sucks, because this place is perfect.
The league had known for a while that the building owner wanted to tear the place down, but they were having trouble finding a new home. Some warehouses were too expensive. Some were too run down. Some of them had pillars too close to the track where skaters would run into them.
Those clear span buildings are harder and harder to find because they're getting torn down and they're being made into multi-purpose buildings that have a Starbucks in the bottom and people living upstairs in like a 600 square foot room that's $3,000 for rent and the bathroom's down the hall. There's just, it's what the city's turning into, unfortunately.
The league nearly signed a deal with a warehouse south of downtown in Seattle's industrial district. But renovating that warehouse into a space fit for athletes and spectators would have required pouring a new floor, installing sprinklers, adding bathrooms, and making the building better able to withstand earthquakes to the tune of about $1 million. The landlord didn't want to wait for Rat City to do all that construction and permitting, so they rented to someone else. That means the league is still actively looking for a new home. And Rat City isn't the only derby league having trouble keeping their space as the cities around them gentrify and old industrial spaces go from cheap and abundant to expensive and scarce.
I know that Portland is experiencing the same thing. They had to move out of their longtime home they've had forever. And I think they're still trying to find a place. So I know that it's not just us. I know that this is happening nationwide.
Carmen understands that building owners can make more money on apartments and retail space than roller derby, but
sometimes the dollar isn't better than investing in things that are useful for people and their sanity.
While Rat City searches for a new space, they're holding practices in rented spaces. Seattle Parks is even letting them paint tracks in community centers so they can hold their 2019 season. But Carmen says she's confident Rat City and roller derby can survive.
It's not how many times you get knocked down, it's how fast you get back up. It's applicable for not just playing the game, but definitely for us being able to find a new place. We know we're going to get knocked down, and that's fine. It's part of the game, but we always get back up.
That story came from reporter Eilish O'Neill in Seattle. Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.